And the theory we make use of is this Yukawa theory, which is the interaction between scalars and the fermions. Makes sense. That's what we know how to quantize. And the interaction Lagrangian is given by one scalar and one fermion bilinear. This is, as I said, the easiest, the simplest Lagrangian we can study. And then, what we have done on the entire Tuesday is to derive some Feynman rules. So what we have seen is that we always draw a dot for the vertex. And then we draw a straight line with arrow for a fermion. And we draw a separate arrow for the direction of momentum. So this tells us it's an incoming fermion. Because the fermion arrow is in the same direction as the momentum arrow. And it's incoming because it's going to a vertex. And what we have seen lecture is this is associated with a U, this solutions, and with some polarization or spin label, if we happen to know, if for an individual fermion, it should carry some spin label, and we would know which, if it's a, say, spin up or spin down fermion going into the vertex. And then we also see that if we have a outgoing fermion, and as I said, if you see the two arrow goes in the same direction, that means it's a fermion. And if you see the arrow point, if the momentum arrow is going away from the vertex, this is an outgoing fermion. And if we see such a thing, we discovered that we should label it with a U bar. And in the tutorial, that what you did is to find those integrals that you need to put it in the LSC reduction formula. And after you express the creation annihilation operator in terms of the fields, then you will then if you do some calculation, find a lot of lots of propagators and can track all your indices, and then you realize the external anti-fermion rule is given like this. So this is an incoming anti-fermion because that the fermion arrow goes different from the momentum arrow. See this, it's not the same because it's an anti-fermion. You need to flip the fermion arrow. And if it's always incoming, the incomingness is defined by the momentum arrow. You look at the momentum, say which particle is going. If it's going into the index, it's an incoming. So this is an incoming anti-fermion. And it turns out that we should associate it with a V bar. And the last one would be the outgoing anti-fermion. Again, outgoing is given by the momentum, and you flip the sign because of the arrow for the fermion arrow because it's an anti-fermion. And we associate it with VR. So that's what we discovered. And you were like, huh, why the difference, right? But if you look at, well, why this is a U and this is a V bar, and why this is a U bar, this is a V. The way to remember, one way to remember is that you look at where the fermion arrow is going. If the fermion arrow is going away from the index, you get a bar. You get something barred. So that's the sentence about this two diagram. And why this has to be the case? Because remember, the important thing about the fermions is not just about the external legs. It's also how, in which order you're gonna write down things. And the order is determined by going with a fermion arrow. It doesn't care about the momentum. In the reverse order. In the reverse order means the first thing I'm going to write down is always going to be some fermion arrow coming out of a vertex. It's either this one or that one, because you're going against the arrow to write down whatever your amplitude. And on the other hand, if you want to write down a Lorentz invariant amplitude, it has to start with a bar, because you have start has a rho vector, and then you have some propagator, whatever. Then you end up with a column. So because it's precisely because that these barred things are rho vector, and then this unbarred things are column vector, and that's exactly why you want to start here, and something happens in between, and here. And if you multiply a rho vector and a column vector in the spinner space, then all the spinner indexes will be contracted, and you get something Lorentzian. So that's why there has to be this difference. Okay, so, well, of course, there are some other rules. For example, this is not too hard to get, the vertex rule. Basically, the idea about a vertex rule, so far we have seen some like three scalar, four scalar, two fermion and one scalar interact. All the vertex rule seems not that complicated. There's a parameter in the Lagrangian. You grab it and you put I in front of it. And it will get slightly complicated in the QED. But the general rule is basically you strip all the fields away from Lagrange. Because as long as it's some sort of a field, it will be eventually wake contracted with somebody else. Whatever is left over will be your vertex rule. And in this case, it's really simple. They are all fields. Just throw them away. They will be taken care of later. And whatever in front is something that wake contraction can't take care of. And that's what's left as a vertex rule. So this, we will have a better understanding at the end of the today when we talk about the QED, and we'll have a good understanding, better understanding, even better understanding tomorrow morning when we're doing tutorial. You will be facing some interaction term that you have not seen before, but they are valid Lagrangian term. And the first thing is, how do I figure out the vertex rule? But this is the general idea. We'll come back to this point. And then at this point, the last thing we need to do is to write down the fermion propagator. We have never seen it because we never draw a diagram that with a fermion as an internal propagator. But this rule is not so hard to figure out. It's a propagator. If you have a diagram has a fermion propagator in the middle, like in the line going, it's not that's an internal propagator, then there's no else SC Dirac operator to kill it, so that it would be just left alone. Okay, so I think that's all the fermion rules, and then there is some minus signs. The golden rule of thumb for minus signs is basically what exactly you did in the weak theorem, in the weak contraction. You are swapping a bunch of fermions. And if you swap fermions, you get minus signs. Then it's summarized in this thing says, if a diagram looks identical to another diagram after odd permutation of external leg, then there is a minus sign, because you swap, basically the claim is you swapped fermions odd number times. For one of the diagram, the other one is even, so there is a relative minus sign between the two diagrams. This is a very weird rule. So let's see how to actually apply this rule. If I draw two diagrams, how am I going to ever figure out if one of them look like it, the other, if I swap all the number of external fermion legs? So the example I'll use is the same example you studied in the tutorial. So this is a thing you study in the tutorial. There's a fermion, fermion bar, goes to fermion, fermion bar. Right? And now I'll be like, okay, we did all the hard work. We know where the Feynman rules come from. Now let's use this technology called Feynman diagrams to write down matrix elements. I'm confident about the correctness of the rules because it's, we went through a lot of work to figure it out. I'm just drawing some lines. And at this point, you could try to draw this two diagram yourself too. And this is the two diagrams that you have studied in your tutorial. And then let me add some labels to the external leg. It doesn't matter how you label it, but you want to be consistent with all the diagrams. So basically, they say fermion and anti-fermion. It could be fermion go this merry way, anti-fermion go its merry way, and they exchange a scale. That's one possible option. The other option is fermion, anti-fermion, annihilate, become a scalar, and it become another pair of fermion, anti-fermion. And normally, this is very different from bosonic theory, different from scalars. In scalars, normally you would think about drawing another channel, is what people often say. And then this is like, if you are very familiar with bosonic theory, you might have drawn this diagram, but it does not exist in fermion theory. No. Not exist. Because if you look at this vertex, it has two arrows going in and no arrows coming out. So this is not a fermion vertex. The fermion vertex always has one arrow going in, one arrow going out. If you are very enthusiastic about fermion theory, you might have two going out. But there cannot have frustrated a vertex like this. The number of fermions coming into the vertex has to be equal to the number of fermions getting out of the vertex. And that essentially is because when you write down any fermion Lagrangian, they always come with bilinears. And that's the thing we know it's Lorentz covariant. Okay, so we have two diagrams. And how am I going to see they have a relative minus sign between them without actually doing the calculation? So the idea is that you can do wake rotation on your diagram. It's not going to change if it's an overall minus sign or not. So you can literally grab this diagram and turn it. So let me see. I'm doing a right 90 degree wake rotation. Oh, let me use the correct words, clockwise. So I just rotate that diagram, and the claim is you can rotate your diagram as you wish, and they are not going to affect the relative minus sign between two diagrams. Which makes sense because during the rotation, I never really swept any fermions. Okay. And then the next thing I do is I'm going to flip. Okay. I should have said you can pick time in any direction, but I get used to pick time to the up. And that's just how I'm going to pick it. You can pick any time direction you want, just stick with it. At least stick with it with the same amplitude. And my experience is once you stick with one time direction, like you can never change. Okay, so I rotate it. And now I'm just saying that I'm gonna flip it. Because this doesn't look like that. This arrow is going up, this arrow is going down, and this is the opposite. This arrow is going up, this arrow is going down. So I'm going to say it's like I'm doing a time reverse. Right? So now basically the arrow, so this diagram looks exactly like this diagram I want to look like. Except my labels are wrong. The diagram itself, it's the same. But my external leg label is at the wrong place. And now I'm just going to be very carefully, say, swapping 3 and 4. Because I'm not going to do anything about the arrows anymore. I'm just relabel my momentum. And then I can swap 2 and 3. And in the last step, I can swap 2 and 4. So here, swap 3 and 4. And the next, I swap. Okay. Maybe it's better if I circle the things. So there's 3 and 4 here, they get a swept. And in the next step, 2 and 3 is swept. So there is 2 and 3 here, and these guys get a swept. And the last guy is obvious. The last guy is whatever I need to swap to this configuration. So that's what that rule says, is that manipulate one of your diagrams. Okay, first of all, your two diagrams have to look similar to begin with. If they don't, once you start a loop diagram, which I can just draw some, if one of them say look like this, the other one look at this, then there's no way that they will ever look like each other. So no minus sign there. So you look at two things that seems has a chance to look like each other, including rotating weak rotation. Then you just try your best to make them actually look exactly like each other. Then you count the number of the switches. So there is this red one, the blue one, and then the pink one, I guess. So you were like, oh, I switched the fermions three times. That's why I concluded there is a minus sign between them. As I said, the overall sign doesn't matter. Only the relative sign between two diagrams is important.
Sorry.
Yeah.
The first time switch the two and three, just switch once, three times.
Yeah, you could do that. It might be always work. So you could just say, I sweep two and three. And that should work, I guess. It's just, I don't like to draw a diagram with, I guess you're right. We're only switching the labels anyway. We're not moving the lines with us. We're just making different names. So there is no fermion line crossing problem. That's right. So sorry for the detour, but you can just swap two and three and it says, oh no, they look the same, but I did one fermion swapping, then it should be a relative minus sign. Okay. But if things get more complicated, you have that to think about. But in this case, you just say, between there and there, I can swap two and three. Okay, good. Now it looks less cluttered. And then there is the last thing, which is not the least. I write it in red, so that everything fits in this board. Fermion loop will give you a minus sign, and the other thing is same. They give you an integration of momentum. And you should also know that they come up with a trace. We'll see this trace again in tutorial tomorrow, or maybe even today. You will have lots of Feynman diagrams to practice. Today's whole afternoon's tutorial is about drawing Feynman diagrams for a process, writing down the matrix elements. So you will have tons of practice. And you still don't look happy. You don't like tons of practice. Well, there is either the tons of practice and then come to the interview facing a Feynman diagram, write down the matrix element, or no practice and come. I strongly recommend not to take the route of the no practice coming in. I highly advertise against it. You should practice lots of Feynman diagrams. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, so what's happening in terms of the actual expression? So when we're doing the weak rotations, we're not changing our actual expressions.
So basically, I think the idea of behinding this is that, remember, what eventually really mattered is how many swapping you did between the fermions. This thing really doesn't quite know about what's the time. And I would say if I did the wake rotation, I would just write down a 2-4 coming in and a 3-1 coming out. So it will basically read wake rotation, bring this guy to the end. Right? So then this operation shouldn't give you minus signs. So that's my theory. I'll test it. I'll let you know. So this, I haven't do it in my head yet, but the flipping is definitely fine. If you just flip two direction of the fermion arrow, it's like if the time now is going downward, like this step is definitely fine. You can see it from the wick.
Okay.
contraction. I can update that part in the notes later. Yeah.
I feel like I said this yesterday, but it's not really a wick rotation, right? Because wick rotation is time to temperature, time to imaginary time.
Right.
This is space. So it's like a little misleading.
All right, let's not call it a wick rotation. Okay. Yeah, well, why don't I think about this clearly, and I'll put it in the notes. And I can write it up in today's tutorial too. Yeah, I will write it crisply clear in terms of all the weak contraction. Hopefully I don't have to do all of them to show that if you just rotate a diagram, it shouldn't affect at all about your minuses. Okay, so I'm gonna instruct to do this later. It's good, every day I get some homework. Homework for me. And I have like an hour and a half, 2 hours. Okay, it's not as long as the other one. Did you guys all check out the shiny new 13th lecture notes with like all the glories of all spinder index restored? I was really proud of myself. But I probably made some mistakes. So if you found any mistakes, please let me know. I think there was like four sets of four spinner index going around. So. Okay, so any other questions before we close this chapter? This chapter has been six lectures and 28 minutes. Yeah, it's all about Dirac's, Dirac fermions. Think about it. If you have any questions, I'm here all day today, all day tomorrow, all day on Monday. So you can think about asking me. And now, what's happening? Okay, thank you. Now the question is, what's the next topic? Ooh. This dark theory. Good guess. Okay, I didn't know it's so dark. Anyway, what do you think we should study in order to get out of the madness of this? Yeah. What should we study? Wait, it works this morning. Happy Halloween. Okay, I need to turn off my earrings. Otherwise, it might be too distracting. All right. So we don't want to live in dark. I conclude. Especially when I'm walking around. That's definitely not a good idea.
Ooh.
Ooh. All right. So people say we should start the QED. Okay, let me just take it off. All right. So we want to study QED, but we should quantize our Maxwell theory first. You have to be turned into some photons, then we can interact. And as you can see in the last quiz, good job, everybody. Most people seems have done well. So Maxwell theory, since I've already written in the quiz, I'll directly write down the Lagrangian. And of course, you should always define these guys. And the most important thing is it's anti-symmetric. And the important thing about Maxwell theory is that they have this gauge symmetry. And if you can check, if you have this, because of this anti-symmetricness, the f mu nu doesn't change. F mu nu invariant. So this Lagrangian is invariant. Okay, so I promised I will talk a little bit about gauge symmetry, but let's see, 3 minutes, maybe two. Okay, the idea is that you have seen, let's put it in the vacuum for now. The vacuum Maxwell theory has such equation of motion. And since we have this new definition of this field strength, we should just put it in, and then we get this term. I'm going pretty fast because I think you've seen them before. And now we end up with an equation of motion of a nu. And at this point is when people often refer as taking a gauge condition. And the gauge condition says that I can pick this thing equals zero. Okay, what is this supposed to mean? Let's flesh it out, because if I just randomly write down a1, a2, a3, a0, there's no reason for this to equal zero, so it probably equals something alpha prime, which might be even a function of x. But the claim is, now I'll make a gauge transformation. So this become let's use tutor, it's easier to see. Okay, and this become this thing. Let's go to this tutor. I want to say coordinate space, but it's not. And the idea is that this is always solvable. You can always solve such a differential equation because you can find the Green function, and now you have a source, so you can find this thing. So this says this gauge condition can always be imposed after picking a specific alpha. But what does that supposed to mean? It means, what exactly does gauge invariant gauge symmetry mean? It basically, it's not a symmetry. If you think about it, it doesn't give you conservation laws like symmetry. The conservation law of electron charge is not given by the gauge symmetry. It's given by the global symmetry. When alpha is a constant, which you actually didn't do anything. So what it is? So I recommend, if you haven't been to Cyberg's talk, which has a Pearson number that, so Cyberg has a whole talk. Well, according to him, a third of talk is devoted in discussion between the real symmetry, which is the global symmetry, a symmetry like a ball that rotates and it looks like the same ball. This kind of symmetry. And they want to contrast with these kind of things we call gauge symmetry, which is not really a symmetry. It's called the gauge redundance. It says we have an description of our theory, and we have a different description. It turned out if you look at the physical things like E and B, they are the same thing, which means we're just describing our world in many, many, many different ways. And they are all equivalent. And they are equivalent through this gauge transformation. And this gauge condition helps us to sort of deal with this redundancy. If we want to actually study what's going on with A's. And gauge, one gauge, see this is one gauge condition. You might have heard from David that one gauge condition will remove 2 degrees of freedom. So of course, imposing this gauge condition will allow us to remove 1 degree of freedom. But it turns out, after that, you bring your field, new field, tilde, into this choose alpha x suitably such that this is true, you can still two-gauge transformation that equals zero. This is also solvable. This also like have solutions. So turns out after you impose your gauge condition, your gauge transformation will transform you within these fields that are already satisfied the gauge condition. It's like you have lots of, you have like, before we start out with 4-dimensional of a description. And now you impose some gauge condition. Then you remove 1 dimension. And turns out that this, you can still do infinite of gauge transformation to relate them. So you want to remove this one too. So then after that, you finally get a set of A's that are actually independent, which were left with 2. So this is what Coulomb does. Coulomb chooses fx such that this is true. So, and if you stare at this, it's very clear there are only 2 degrees of freedom left. You have 3 to start with. And you're like, what about A0? A0 is, what about A0? A0 is actually very interesting. If you think about it, that you actually, it doesn't have a term called like this. It's not in the Lagrange. Right? And this is because this antisymmetricness. Like F00, it just equals 0. And which means it doesn't even have an evolution equation. It's very different from other things. Normally what we are familiar with, we have a position, we have velocity, we integrate the velocity, get position. And in a field theory, we have psi dot, we have psi at the time equals 0, and hopefully you can do some integration, you get psi at the later time. But A0 doesn't have an evolution equation. A0 is completely determined by the other three things. So this is, actually, in this particular gauge, you can show that A0 equals 0. So in Coulomb gauge, it's the clearest way to see this redundancy. Because you could have just chosen A0 to 0, and that would not change anything. And then in addition, you can impose this gauge. OK, so there are 2 degrees of freedom. But in our case, we'll stick with the Lorentz gauge, which is manifestly Lorentz invariant, but it's actually proposed by Lorentz without a T. And this guy is kind of, it's like he is also a very good, very, very good physicist. And he has proposed this Lorentz gauge that everybody use for Maxwell theory. But lots of people call this gauge Lorentz gauge because he is unfortunately one letter from the famous Lorentz. So we will stick with this gauge because it's Lorentz invariant. And we have seen for a long time that it's good to have Lorentz invariance for our theory, and it makes a lot of things easier. Like if you know that what we want to write down is learn. If you go to the Coulomb gauge, you can quantize it, but at every time you ask any question, you're like, is my result Lorentz invariant? But then it's not manifest, because it only have, say, A1, A2. But it's easy in some way, but not as general. And you can think about if there is an electric wave going this direction perpendicular to me, then this wave has two polarization. One of is going up and down, the other one is going like this. So two. And if you're interested, you can ask Eggy. Apparently quantum optics exclusively uses this Coulomb gauge. And if you're very interested, you can look at David Tang. He actually quantized it in both ways. But in our lecture, we'll stick with the Lorentz gauge. Okay, what the Lorentz gauge gives us? Well, the reason we want to impose this gauge condition is that term just disappeared, right? Isn't that nice? It's always nice to make an equation of motion easier. So this is what we're going to study. Maybe I should write out my box. This is our focus today. This is the Maxwell Langevin plus Lorentz gauge. What does this look like?
Klein-Gordon equation with your mass.
Excellent. This is the massless Klein-Gordon equation. Then we shall solve it likewise. And remember, Klein-Gordon equation is really not that hard to solve. It really just says there is some plane wave plus some other, but it's real. So I can just write it like this. But there is a problem, right? Plane wave is not a vector. I need a vector. So in order to match the vector index, this E nu comes out, says, okay, I'm just this vector that you put it in front of plane wave to make your whole solution looks like a vector. This is exactly analogous to this U and the Vs we put in front of the plane wave for Dirac field. It's something we put in front of the plane wave such that it's Lorentz covariant, in fact. Covariant solution. And the next thing you do, you say there are four solutions. And then you sum it over. So that should be it. And why four? Well, because we're solving a space-time four-dimension vector, and I'm very, very welcome to pick a orthonormal base like that. See, one, two, three, four solutions. This is sort of like is like the simplified U and Vs, because the U and Vs need to satisfy some Dirac equation of their own, but for my this thing called the polarization vector, it can be anything I want at this moment. And again, it comes with this solution index, run from 0 to 3 because it's a vector. And I write this. Okay, solved. And then you suddenly will be like, wait a minute, I have a Lorentz condition. I better see what the Lorentz condition gives me. And then what it gives me is I'll just do the derivative. It's good all these things in front of it. Huh. That's the solution. But then there should be also a coefficient. And it has to be some. That makes sense, because otherwise it would be the solution index floating around. Yeah, so it's the same idea. If you have a solution, for each solution, you should have a solution coefficient. So this is what we have seen before. And of course, I should write the other half. Okay, so this is the complete solution. And integrated over momentum. Okay, now it should be complete. So I can just write the solution. Basically, the solution is plane wave in this direction, plane wave in that direction, plane wave in this direction, plane wave in this direction. And then for each individual solution, you can put some coefficient in front of it. And then you add the complex conjugate to make it real. Okay, sorry for the delay. But now let's look at what the Lorentz gauge gives us. It gives us that by doing a derivative, I'm going to bring out a k nu. And it tells us this should be equal to zero. We will add the coefficients later. Sorry. At this point, we'll just look at these solutions. We'll add the coefficients. Oh, let me choose the simple coefficients that they all want. Well, it should work when all the coefficients is one. So then you should get that. Okay, so now, as usual, we're just going to pick a simple case says that the peak wave moves in the z direction. And we can write our momentum as something that only have the zeros component and the third component. And this will give us epsilon zero times k plus epsilon three plus times k is zero for any solution. So because I could have just picked the first solution and all the second solution, all the third solution with coefficient one with the coefficient. So this should be satisfied for any solution. So the coefficient can be chosen to be one, and we're only looking at this particular solution. So Sorry, I'm confused. So what we want to do here is that is to have a, so this is the K mu should be equals to 0, and we should have x0 dot into k plus epsilon 1 dot into k plus epsilon 2 dot into k and plus 3 dot into k equals 0.
So,
yeah.
We have a minus sign.
Very good. That's definitely a minus sign.
Are you using the different metric?
Just the other notation. The other
matter.
Zero.
It's zero, so it doesn't matter. So the idea is that we always pick this thing to be true. So no matter what's your momentum, you will pick your first and the second direction to be perpendicular to the momentum. It's like what they say is that when the field is propagating, it's the transverse condition. You can always pick two of the, there's going to be a plane perpendicular to the propagation direction. So we always pick that, and then we'll write our condition as this.
Why do we have that minus sign?
We just sum.
Right, okay, we're summing over four things. Right, there is no minus sign, sorry. So with this plus sign coming through, we're just summing over the polarizations. And you can see that if you have a momentum in the z direction, of course this epsilon 1 and epsilon 2 is naturally perpendicular. And then since all the momentum can come, you can just Lorentz transform this momentum to any momentum you like, and then you do the transformation on this set so that this condition is always satisfied. And then we have Lorentz condition imposed on the polarization factor. And the last thing I want to say before the break is that these things are normally picked in a way that it's also normal. And then there is the other one. I'll write it down. If you contract with the lambda lambda prime, you are also. So that's how much we can learn from the classical theory of Maxwell theory. We solve it, we impose our gauge condition, we have a bunch of polarization vectors, And in 5 minutes, we'll quantize this theory. Let's say that this is the coefficient. We will add the coefficient separately back. Let me erase this. We'll pick the basis later. Just talk about the gauge condition. So if this also carries momentum dependence, it basically, that's what the A used to do us anyway. And now, if we take the gauge condition, we always have this. And then this is a appropriate gauge condition. And that's just writing it all out. And we can always pick the middle two term is zero, and such that our gauge condition is summarized as this thing. And the picking a specific plane wave and picking specific epsilons is only a discussion relevant for this. That's just an example to show this is true. You can pick a certain plane wave and you are immediately able to find this four epsilons such that this condition is satisfied. Okay. So let's quantize Maxwell theory. What are we waiting for? We have a recipe, we have a theory, let's quantize it. Okay, remember our recipe says, pick a Lagrangian. Oh, I don't need to pick. I have one. And step two, chondrolytic momentum, pi. Let me calculate pi. Well, there are four of them. We'll calculate one by one. Pi zero is equals to partial Lagrangian, partial zero, a zero. What is this? Small exercise. What's pi zero for a zero? Zero. What? Oops. Wait, this is very bad. This is very spooky. How am I supposed to impose? I'm supposed to carry on my calculation, do something like this and I and the stuff. This is where I'm going after. And you follow your recipe happily to the second step, you find a zero momentum. No matter how you argue, you just can't argue zero and a commutator could not be zero. Zero is zero. You're like, okay, now I'm stuck. Okay, let's go back to step one. Well, I still want to quantize Maxwell, that's for sure. But I need to do something with Lagrangian. So the idea is why would we be so happy, says these are just four massless Klein-Gordon, I can use all the knowledge that I studied from Klein-Gordon to do things, is that we did a thing. We picked the Lagrangian, and we get equation of motion. So what so far happened is from Lagrangian, we get equation of motion. Then we impose the gauge condition. And then we get a Klein-Gordon equation. So this Klein-Gordon equation didn't come out of your Lagrangian. In between, you impose the gauge condition, and apparently there's a huge price to pay, which is one of your conjugate momentum is zero. So that's not good. So the idea is, what we want is hopefully to have a Lagrangian that has equation of motion is already Klein-Gordon equation. And this Lagrangian equals to, let's call this nu, is equals to L old if the gauge condition is true. So as far as we concern, the physical thing, that the thing that after we impose the gauge condition is always true. So that Lagrangian actually is not hard to guess, because what people normally do is you have a gauge condition, great. We'll just add something like the gauge condition square into the Lagrangian. You square it because you sort of want them to be at the same order. So that's what the people do. And is this one really nice that give you what we want, which is Klein-Gordon equation? For Klein-Gordon equation after equation of motion, you can check, yes. So you can check that this equation of motion is exactly what we want. We get this dot box A nu equals zero. And then you're like, let's quantize it. It turned out it's much easier if you use a thing which is called the redundancy of the Lagrangian. Like, remember, yeah.
These books happens with all gauge theories, or is only for maximum?
It probably happens to all the gauge theories, because all the gauge theories is defined with this kind of anti-symmetric field tensor. It just tells you that you can't just pick the gauge theory and try to quantize it. And in QFT2, after learn the past integral, they have other ways to remedy. But yes, it's always a problem. It's always like, because you use some redundant description, and this redundancy will show up somewhere. And it show up here, says your conjugate momentum is zero, means your field is not even it's not even an evolutionary field. Your field is completely dependent on the other field. It's not evolving, so that's why we shouldn't have a momentum for you. So that's the claim that is saying this is the same statement as A0 completely determined by AI.
So we first always need to quantize and then gauge fits.
Yes, that's exactly the proposal. The proposal is we forget about this gauge condition thing for now. Of course, we'll pay a huge price, but we'll pay the price later. We'll enjoy our moment that the quantization part is easy. That's the spirit. And it turns out, see, this doesn't look like the best Lagrangian to quantize. So we're not going to do this either. We're going to use this thing called a cute Lagrangian. And it looks really cute. Look at this guy. If you just turn A nu into like a phi I, and the I goes from 1 to 4, that's exactly what you have for 4. So not only we are able to get the equation of motion looks like a Klein-Gordon equation, you can actually manipulate Maxwell's Lagrangian into look like exactly the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian. You have the same Lagrangian, same equation of motion. The only price we paid is we haven't the gauge fixed. And the relationship between this cute Lagrangian we're going to quantize, because we know exactly how to quantize this thing, because we quantized it in the first week of QFT, second lecture. The difference between these two is a boundary term. You can just subtract this two Lagrangian. You can show that the thing is a total derivative. And it's shown in the lecture. So now we're very happy, because we have 4 Klein-Gordon massless Lagrangian. We can't be more happy. Look at this. We can just copy down exactly what we do for Klein-Gordon. Now we happily calculate our conjugate momenta, which should be this. I think there is a minus sign. There is a minus sign. Okay. If you calculate your conjugate momentum, you get that, which makes sense because we know that the Klein-Gordon conjugate momentum involves the derivative of the field. And then the next thing we do is we happily impose our relationship. So that's I delta x minus y. And now I have a index, so I have to put something to make the Lorentz index looks correct. But this is basically how we do things in the Klein-Gordon theory, and that's exactly what we're gonna do right here. So let's check, sanity check. I'm taking AI, and then I'm taking pi j. This will give me AI minus A dot j, which is minus delta ij, delta x minus y, if it's a Klein-Gordon theory. And that minus sign match with my metric convention that ij is a minus. You're like, wait, still behaves like a Klein-Gordon theory, so what should I be worried about? Well, I don't know so far. And then you can say, this thing, of course, should give you, if you write them with some coefficient, then the coefficient must have a commutator relationship doesn't have that one. For each solution, you have some operator, and this operator should have the correct commutator relationship. And because our Lagrangian is nothing but for massless Klein-Gordon equation, so why should I expect anything different? So that minus sign is chosen precisely because we know in the space dimension, it's exactly a copy of Klein-Gordon. So what about the time component? Well, time component, we got a minus sign in front, which is worrisome. We'll be unhappy about it, but so far nothing yields at me that I'm doing anything wrong. So we use these operators back. I can expand my field. So I just break it into two parts. Explain the Klein-Gordon equation. How you explain the Klein-Gordon field? You have the plus field and the minus field, and you have the coefficient, and you have the operators. And you're like, what now? We quantized it. We have a quantized field, we impose our commutator relationship, we're done. They were like, okay, sure. We can study states. Why not? There are states. I started with a vacuum. Do the same thing. says this should be equals rule, right? And then if I use this dagger thing, they should give me a one particle state. At this point, you should be bored. Maybe at this point, this is exciting. It's like, oh, it doesn't work. We have to use a new Lagrangian. But after we write down this Lagrangian, I'm just writing down like half a board of boring stuff. You have already seen it in Gordon theory, except it carries some index now. Right? So let's examine. So we call this particle state a particle carrier momentum P and a polarization level lambda. So let's examine the states by ask, what's the norm of the state? Okay, I know how to calculate that. This gave me the other guy. Not summing over. This is gonna be difficult, but not summing over. Because I'm only, oh, wait, I can take lambda be zero. Because I want to investigate on the zero component of the particle. Very good. Then I use commutator relationship. Except the time component of this creation operator has a minus sign. So it's going to be minus something. Something. So it depends on the normalization of the good guys. Okay, now that there is something yelling to us, it's wrong. We look at our one particle states. We should have four of them because we have four different kinds of solutions. We have four different kinds of creation operators. But then if we investigate at the time component particle, one particle state, we realize it has a negative norm. What is negative norm supposed to mean? Well, one way we're going to do things is that we're going to say these are the bad states. We're just going to label them as bad states if they have negative norm. And of course, what we need to do is to remove the bad guys. Bad states. We have to give a prescription. Somehow, the things we call the physical states that's related to physical world, we shouldn't have these states. It has negative norm. We don't want them. So we're going to come up with a method, which is called the Gupta-Bloyer method, is to remove these bad states systematically. Because now, if this guy is bad, if you create two, would it be bad? But it's like there's going to be so many bad ones out there. Then you were like, why you have the freedom says, oh, you are bad, I'll just kick you out. You are bad, I'll kick you out. Who gave us this power to remove the bad states? Why it's not an insane thing to do is like, I have a theory that doesn't look right. Oh, I'll just find that all the parts making it not look right go away. That's not how we should normally do things. But in this case, we do have this power. Remember the thing that we have been forget about it for a while? Is that we actually have never imposed our gauge condition yet. And this is a good time to do it. Because gauge condition hopefully will help us to remove all the guys so that we live in a world that only have the physical degree of freedom and happily ever after. All right, so here's a proposal. I'm going to impose this as an operator equation. I say this thing is true all the time. it turned out that's a very, very high hope. It's a too strong a condition. Because you can show that the derivative of the propagator, whatever your propagator is, of the proper propagator, it doesn't matter what it looks like for now, it's not zero. It's your propagator looks something like p squared minus m squared plus epsilon e to the I minus I px. And here with photons, the most likely thing is you are gonna pick up a minus epsilon mu nu. The minus sign is for the space direction, it's correct. Okay, so this thing is your propagator. It depends on x and y. And now I say, let me do derivative of this x and hope that it always vanish. That doesn't make any sense. So this is impossible task. Impossible. That's the difference between classical and quantum theory, is that you can impose that as a classical condition, that's fine. But you can't just say, let's take it as an operator equation and impose quantum mechanically. It fell off. Doesn't work. So let's lose this situation a little bit and demand that only the physical states is zero. Only impose our condition on the physical states. There are all these negative normal states. Of course, they are not zero, which is great because I'm going to throw them away. And turns out this is also a very strong condition. Also impossible. Well, it's not impossible, also problematic. The biggest problem about this proposal is that this, your vacuum, is no longer physical. So this is a very big problem. We always want our vacuum to be physical. And then, so we can keep retreating, says, okay, I'll just only taking the annihilation operator. And then now I demand this thing is physical. So this is the condition we're actually going to impose. And we also impose the other half. And you can actually show that what being imposed that is actually resembling the gauge condition we initially have is that take our gauging condition, not impose as an operator equation, but we demand any physical states have zero expectation of. And this is the Gupta-Boyer condition. And what does this achieve for us? Is that, what does this achieve to us? Is that you actually calculate this using this expansion. And that gave us acting on physical state equals zero. So this is like the original classical gauge condition we write up, except now we impose it after it's acting on physical state, it's zero. And then we're going to use the condition that k dot epsilon 1 can be taken to be 0, and the k dot epsilon 2 can also be taken to be 0. So the middle two disappeared because we choose our polarization, choose our physical polarization to be perpendicular to the wave.
So they're both zero independent.
Yes, you can pick, the idea is can pick epsilon 1 dot k 0, epsilon 2 dot k 0. That's always possible. And then what we have left with is this thing. But remember, we have the condition is the other two should add to be zero. So I can turn this guy into a minus sign of this guy. So what I have is that. And what it says is that, fine, it imposes a condition about the time component of the photon and the longitudinal component of photon, if you choose it to traveling in the three condition. And this says, so if you square this guy, and you get to the idea is that the number operator is always the same. So if you square it and the number operator shows up, the number operator shows up. And the last thing, remember that so far we have never cared to mention about the Hamiltonian, but that's always what's the first thing. We look at it. So we should have looking at our Hamiltonian. So our Hamiltonian turns out to be look like what we expected. What we expected is this thing times the Lambert operator for each type of the particle. So this, for the space component, which is really nice, basically it gives you the number particle of the first type plus the number particle the second time. And then, of course, it still have number particle of the third time, the number particle of the zero type and the three type. But this metric ensures that you get a minus sign for the number of the time component of the particles. And we just said what Gupta-Bloyer condition does for us is after you compose that condition, this thing cancels. Which means that in the real world, all we can observe are those two physical modes. Like you can calculate all sorts of observable using your mode expansion, and then you calculate, and eventually you will realize whatever you try to calculate, it would never depend on either the time component or the longitudinal component of the field, or the correlation operator. It's just always independent. There's no observable you can design to actually detect ever the existence of the zero type and the three type. And it's literally a gauge redundancy. you introduce the other two components of the photons to fulfill the purpose that you have a really nice Lagrangian quantize. Like if you look at the Coulomb gauge says, okay, we're gonna focus on this physical mode of photon and quantize them. Then you wouldn't be like, hey, this is just Klein-Gordon, I have done everything, I have done all the work. And just do it, it will be much harder. So it's indeed, it's not a symmetry. It's that we didn't describe our world with the true degree of freedom. We decided to introduce two extra degrees of freedom so our life of studying them is easier. We just have to always remember, we need to impose our gauge condition somehow so that these things that we introduce, which are not physical, doesn't affect our physical. So that's the story about Maxwell. And the Maxwell also have Feynman rules, but they say this can't be hard. That's just the polarization level in equals 0, 1, 2, 3. It's a label, it's like the spin label. And then this is going in, this is going out, which you can't tell because it doesn't have an arrow with it. So it's the same. You just have to remember this is whatever the outgoing photon carries something, and whatever the incoming photon is going to carry. And then the only other thing you can write down is this, with the minus sign. That's the propagator. And then what we need in the end is the QED vertex. So here is the first example you would say the vertex is slightly more complicated than you used to see in the earlier series. Is that, so I'm gonna do this. Say I said, how do I get a vertex rule? You throw away the field, you throw away the field, you throw away the field, because they are all later going to be somewhere in the wake contraction. So they are all taken care of. And what hasn't been taken off is this guy. And you write an I above. Ta-da! And then tomorrow you will see a couple theories that you want to derive the vertex rule for yourself. And as usual, I will see you guys in 3.5 hours for a Feynman diagram boot camping.